This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Brian Wagner at the controls this morning. A quick mention that tomorrow morning on the program in hour number one, we'll be talking with Jonathan Bean. He is an historian at Southern Illinois University. We'll be discussing his book, Big Government and Affirmative Action. The subtitle is The Scandalous History of the Small Business Administration. Then in the second hour, we'll explore the relationship between mental illness and creativity. And we'll have several guests, Patsy Hollister from the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, Kate Uline, she's an artist who lives in Champaign, and also Trudy Good. She has a doctorate in clinical psychology from University of Illinois and is clinical manager at Provena Behavioral Health. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week and always give you the opportunity to call in when you have questions and comments. The foreign policy of the United States is being remade even as we speak as a result of the terrorist attacks that took place in September. The relationships between this country and many others are changing and are expected to continue to change in the weeks and the months ahead. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll concentrate primarily on the relationship between Russia and the United States. Our guest is David Holloway. He's professor of political science at Stanford University in Stanford, California. And among his interests, Soviet and post-Soviet politics, and also post-Cold War international security. He's written a lot on these topics. Just to mention one title that got a lot of attention when it was published, a book that came out in 1994 titled Stalin and the Bomb, The Soviet Union and Atomic Energy, covering the period between 1939 and 1956. Got a lot of notice. It was named, among other things, it was named the New York Times Book Review by the Book Review as one of the best books in that year, 1994. He will be in Champaign-Urbana a little bit later this week to take part in a couple of events, discussions of nuclear disarmament and U.S.-Russia relations. And a little bit later on, I'll give you some more information on that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to be involved. And of course, here this morning, we'd welcome whatever questions, comments you have. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and we'll pay for the call. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Holloway, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate
it.
Just as a general point, it does seem to be the case that U.S. foreign policy had been, in the post-Cold War period, had been drifting. There didn't seem to be a strong organizing principle, but now it would seem that we have one. And it seems, it almost seems impossible to overstate just what this means, how much the effort that the United States has embarked on to deal with terrorism, just how much that may reshape the foreign policy of this country.
I agree with that. I think after the Cold War, people were casting around for an organizing principle for American foreign policy to replace the idea of containment, which really had survived right through the Cold War, the idea of containing Soviet power, bottling up the Soviet Union, preventing it from expanding. And now in the most kind of unexpected and tragic way, we found this organizing principle, and it's a principle of counterterrorism, of fighting terrorism wherever it is. And I think that that will and is already reshaping U.S. relations with countries around the world, and it's very difficult to predict, how all of this will play out, but it does seem clear the U.S. is going to focus on this as its main foreign policy goal in the coming years.
The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has said publicly that he supports the U.S. effort against terrorism. It's clear that he's interested in having some things in exchange. But putting that aside for just a moment, perhaps we could talk about what it is that either the Russians have done or they are in a position to do to assist the United States in this effort.
Well, they've done a number of things. Some of them have been rhetorical, saying that they will make common cause with the United States against terrorism. Also, an important role that they can play is a diplomatic role in terms of support at the United Nations and so on, which they have certainly done. Another element, and I think in some ways a difficult one for them, has been to agree or not oppose the stationing of U.S. troops in the Central Asian states that were formerly part of the Soviet Union and that Russia has been has considered part of its own sphere of influence. There may well be cooperation in intelligence as well. In fact, that's very likely. And it's possible at some point, although that point has certainly not come yet, that Russian troops or Russian forces in some way might be involved in combat. So it's a very clear political stance, and a political stance taken where Russia has had to take some positions that don't meet with complete support inside the country.
Mm. Just for a moment, let's talk about the American, this developing relationship that we now have with Uzbekistan. The government of Uzbekistan said that it would allow American forces to use its territory for a limited range of purposes, to do search and rescue missions, to bring in supplies. What the government said that it would not allow is airstrikes to be launched from there. I guess just recently I've heard also that the government is apparently thinking that it's possible that it would allow some commando action perhaps to be launched, some land action to be launched from there. But as you say, here among the many firsts that maybe we have seen and we will see in this particular case where now we have the troops of the United States stationed in a country that was at one time part of the Soviet Union, that it seems just on the face of it to be fairly remarkable.
I think it is remarkable, and I think if you had said 10 years ago, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that this would happen, it would have seemed unlikely. And if you had said it, 2 years ago, after the great Russian opposition and unhappiness about the, U.S. involvement in the war over Kosovo, it would have seemed inconceivable. And here, Russia is acquiescing in this. I mean, Putin has really, I think, gone out of his way to offer support to President Bush. And I think many people in Russia wonder, is this a good thing to do? Because doesn't it just mean now we'll have the United States in our backyard? Who knows when those troops will leave? Doesn't it give the U.S. great influence over the states of Central Asia? And I think many people in Russia have qualms about this, but I think the Putin decision has been a very clear-cut one.
Mm. Do you think, I know there is a lot of speculation about this, that in fact that U.S. troops might be there for some long period of time, not just for however long this operation lasts, 3 months, 6 months, who knows, that indeed the U.S. presence there might be there for the foreseeable future?
I don't know what the plans are for keeping the troops there, but I do know that the great fear on the Russian side, or at least among some Russians, indeed not only in Russia, I've seen the same fear being expressed in India, is that under the cover of anti-terrorist operation, the U.S. will move to assume a kind of dominant position in Central Asia and in the Caspian Basin, where it has other interests besides those of counterterrorism, there are oil interests, energy interests, and that it will be very difficult to dislodge the United States from that position once it's actually in there. I'm not saying that that's what the U.S. Policy is. I think the administration is absolutely focused on the counterterrorism mission, but that's the kind of apprehension that arises among those who think that Russia shouldn't have moved quite so quickly to back U.S. policy. On the other hand, you might say, well, Uzbekistan is an independent state, and it's not up to Russia to tell it what it should do, and that perhaps Putin was only rather graciously bowing to the inevitable on this. But he could have made some difficulties, surely, if he had wanted to.
Mm. Let's talk for a moment about the interests of the government of Uzbekistan. It seems that certainly in the very recent past, if the Uzbeks had wanted to have a relationship with some major power, that the two leading choices would be China and Russia, because that's they're wedged in between the Chinese and the Russians. And here with the United States, with our interest in being involved in this part of the world, here now they have a third alternative. What are they interested in?
Well, I think what Uzbekistan is interested in is it's very concerned about its own internal security. It has come under attack from Islamic radicals connected to the Taliban, and there is an Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, I think not terribly powerful, but nevertheless enough to cause anxiety in Tashkent. And I think, so they are happy, I think, to be part of this anti-Taliban alliance, though of course also somewhat fearful that being part of it will make them more of a target for those groups. And I think that explains in part the kinds of restrictions they wanted to put on the use of their facilities by U.S. planes. But to come back to your question about Uzbekistan and its positioning itself between, you know, China, Russia, and now the United States, the Clinton administration in the early 90s did in fact move to establish relations with Uzbekistan, I mean military-to-military relations, and in some sense those are paying off now, because the administration had the view then that in dealing with these newly independent countries, it was often, and this was the position that the Pentagon took, Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, was that if you establish good military-to-military relations between the U.S. and these countries, you not only would have good friends in the country, but you could also play a role in contributing to democratization, because you could talk about principles of civilian control and so on. So, in fact, relations between Uzbekistan and the United States, although they haven't been so close over the last few years, were not non-existent. And I think that probably has helped, actually, in making Uzbekistan receptive to the idea of U.S. forces there.
Mm. And is there for us, given the fact that it's a place where the government rules with a very strong hand, there's a lot of control over media, they're very hard on dissidents. The leader, Islam Karimov, became the leader of the country in 1990. He's held office ever since. He was elected in last year in a race. Even the guy who was running against him voted for Mr. Karimov. Is there any problem for us in becoming allied with a government like this?
Oh, I think there are problems. I'm afraid the war against terrorism, well, as the saying is, the politics make strange bedfellows. So I think in the war against terrorism, when you focus on a particular group, you like trying to deal with Osama bin Laden or the Taliban, then you form alliances with some regimes you would otherwise not want to form alliances with. Moreover, I think there has to be a general problem that if in the fight against terrorism you form alliances with conservative or autocratic regimes, then you run the risk of backing states that may themselves ultimately be overthrown. I mean, backing losers, political losers, or backing countries that don't uphold the principles you are fighting to uphold in the war against terrorism. Yeah, I think this is a very difficult issue for the U.S. and a very difficult issue in how you put together a coalition to fight terrorist groups.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Holloway. He's professor of political science at Stanford University. Among his interests, Soviet and post-Soviet politics and post-Cold War international security. We're talking about, started out talking about the relationship between Russia and the United States and how it has changed and maybe is likely to change as the foreign policy of this country changes as a result of the terrorist attacks that took place in September. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Going back here to talk about Russia and the United States, the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, has said that he supports the United States in its battle against terrorism. And it seems very clear that among the things he is interested in is for the rest of the world to limit its criticism of Russia and its policy in Chechnya, because he's said right out in so many words that he thinks that the war that Russia has been fighting in Chechnya is part of the same battle, the international battle against terrorism. And I know there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the fact that the rest of the world, particularly United States and the NATO countries, would indeed shelve their concerns about Russia and its human rights record in Chechnya as a way of continuing to have the Russian support for what we want to do in our anti-terrorism battle. How does the United States walk that line?
Well, I think it's a difficult line to walk, and the U.S. has, you know, taken through the 90s rather different positions on the Russian war in Chechnya. You remember that President Clinton at one point came close to comparing President Yeltsin with Abraham Lincoln, that he was just trying to hold the country together. More recently, the U.S. has been more critical of Russian policy. My own feeling is that Putin's position here is only partially true. There is evidence of the involvement of people connected with, Osama bin Laden in the Chechen war, but it's not primarily about that. It's been primarily a nationalist war, not a religious war, a nationalist war by the Chechens to seek independence from Russia. And I think to convert this into to say that this now is part of the war against terrorism is really quite misleading. And I think the U.S., whether it, you know, somehow quietens its criticism, nevertheless should not stop its criticism of Russian policy in the region, which has been exceptionally brutal. Moreover, I think the same applies to the European states. The German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder recently said they'd have to rethink their attitude to Chechnya, implying they would have to be less critical of Russian policy. But I think it's a mistake. I think one can draw closer to Russia, but nevertheless say there are some issues on which we, feel that we must criticize what you're doing, and it would be much better for our relations if you were to adapt your policy or pursue it in a less brutal way than you're doing at the moment.
Perhaps we ought to just for a moment for people who are listening who aren't really sure what the Chechen war is about or what has happened, just very briefly talk about that. There certainly has been tension and bad blood between the Russians and the Chechens for a long time, but the more recent conflict goes back to the to the attempted coup in Russia, the coming apart of the Soviet Union, and then at that point, the stated intention by the Chechens to become independent. What seems to be going on here is, as far as the Russians are concerned, is that they saw the Soviet Union fall apart. And that happened. But when it looked like the same sort of thing might happen with Russia, which indeed is an entity made up of these various constituencies that are interested in anything from greater autonomy to independence, it seems that the Russians were drawing the line here and making an example of the Chechens and saying, no way, we're not going to see Russia come apart the way we saw the Soviet Union come apart. Is that basically it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The Chechens have wanted independence. Initially, the Russian government decided to ignore the claims because they had so many other issues to deal with in 1992 and 93, and then decided to use military force to bring the Chechens into line. Whereas in other cases of regions that wanted great autonomy or might even have teetered on the brink of asking for independence, the Russians negotiated, made concessions, did deals. But that didn't work out in the Chechen case. I think they mishandled it rather badly. Actually, on both sides mishandled it. And the Russians launched a war. The defense minister, Pavel Grachev, said, you know, it'll just take a couple of weeks. But of course, then there was a ceasefire in 96. But then Putin launched a second war in the run-up to his own election as president. And it is a very nasty and difficult war, and it's very hard to see what the political outcome will be. And Putin, this seems to be an issue on which he is quite emotional in the sense that when criticism is directed at him personally for the policy, he reacts in a very emotional way. So that doesn't augur very well for, you know, a peaceful settlement to this terrible crisis.
Hmm. Well, it seems to be the case, as I remember it, that the tough position he took on Chechnya and his having this image of being the guy who was really going to take care of this problem and who was going to do it by being tough and aggressive, that had a lot to do with his being elected president of Russia.
Yes, it did. He played the nationalist card. It was a popular move in the way that the first war had not been popular. But it's also, the Chechen war has to my mind, a somewhat poisonous effect throughout the whole political system because the government has tried very much to control the media coverage. And media coverage was very important in the first war in the early 90s in arousing public opposition to the policy that the government was pursuing there, I mean, opposition to the war. So I think that, yes, this has been an element in his popularity. I think as there's no kind of solution to the problem, it tends then to, I think, to be beginning to work against him. But if he can tie this, I mean, he has an incentive to tie this to the U.S. anti-terrorist campaign, but I think the U.S. Has every incentive not to let him do that, to dissociate or differentiate between what it is doing and what he has been doing in Chechnya. And that, as you say, isn't always that easy to do. Hmm.
We are at our midpoint here, and I'd like to mention again that our guest is David Holloway. He teaches at Stanford University and has done a lot of research and writing about Soviet and post-Soviet politics. And I'd like to take a second here to mention two programs that are going to be taking place on the University of Illinois campus involving our guest coming up at the end of this week. There will be a workshop taking place on Friday afternoon discussing multilateral nuclear disarmament. This is sponsored by the Center for the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. So that will be Friday at 1:30 in the afternoon in the International Studies Building. And then on Saturday, a forum discussing Russia and how it has changed and its relationship with the United States. And this is sponsored by the Arms Control Program, but also the Russian and East European Center, International Programs and Studies, and the European Union Center, among others. And this talk will be taking place in the Law School Auditorium Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, and our guest, David Holloway, will be taking part. Also, the keynote speaker for this will be General William Odom. He's a senior fellow and director of national security studies at the Hudson Institute. He's also former director of the National Security Agency, and he has written a lot about the Soviet military. He will be a guest on this program on our show on Thursday. Again, talking with us by telephone. So we'll be talking with him on a number of things. We'll talk a little bit about intelligence and intelligence gathering and its role in dealing with terrorism, perhaps also talking about the potential role for the military in battling terrorism and some other subject as well. So for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, these events are open to anybody who would like to attend. So if they're interesting, sound interesting to you, you should certainly take them in. And as I mentioned, General Odom will be talking with us on this program on Thursday at 10 o'clock. This morning here on Champaign, here in Focus 580, we are inviting your calls and questions. As always, we're talking about relations between Russia and the United States. Our guest, David Holloway, from Stanford University. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Not going back not very long, certainly going back before September 11th, it seemed that the big bone of contention between Russia and the United States was the stated intention by the United States to develop a system to defend against a missile attack. Our stated intention to walk away from the ABM treaty, whether the Russians liked it or not. And there, not very long ago, some months back, there were talks involving the governments of the United States and of Russia. And it seemed that the stories we got from each side were rather different. On the side of the United States, they seemed to be saying that they felt that the Russians were willing to negotiate on this point, and that we would be working on a new kind of arms control understanding with Russia, and that missile defense was going to be folded in. The Russians on their side, very quickly after the United States put out that sort of spin, the Russians said, oh, no, that's not quite right. We're still not happy about missile defense. We think that we should continue to abide by the ABM treaty. And it made one think that, well, it didn't really look like there was too much room for negotiating there. Given now everything that has happened, what do you think is going to then happen with this discussion between the United States and Russia on missile defense?
I think it's actually very difficult to say what the impact of these events will be. But I think what we do see is a drawing together of Russia and the United States, and I think I guess from that negotiations on these issues are likely to be more successful. My understanding is that, I think you're exactly right. There were these two versions coming out from Washington and Moscow about the nature of the talks, but the Russian administration was pleased at the very least that some talks were going on, because they had seen in the Bush administration a willingness just to go ahead without consultations at all. So I think what they were concerned about was to try to get the U.S. into talks and to kind of stretch out the decision-making on the U.S. side, so it wouldn't be so precipitate to kind of overthrow the ABM treaty. And it may well be that the recent events will just push the missile defense issue somewhat onto the back burner, so that it won't come up as such an immediate kind of irritant in relations. Secondly, I think my own view is that the Russians, in the end, would be willing to reach some kind of agreement, because if they were faced with a choice between the U.S. going ahead with missile defense with no limitations or no framework, and the U.S. going ahead within some kind of framework, they would prefer some kind of framework, because it would give them some predictability or some sense of what, you know, what was going to happen in coming years. So I think that it was a very delicate issue for the Russian government, and I think now it probably will be easier to reach some kind of agreement. But then we don't know exactly how this is going to play out in the Bush administration on missile defense policy. I think there was another very important bone of contention, and that was the issue of NATO enlargement, because there's to be a summit in Prague next summer where new members are supposed to be admitted to NATO. And the most kind of contentious point has been admission of the Baltic states, which were formerly part of the Soviet Union, into NATO. And I think even before September the 11th, one could discern a something of a shift in Russian policy. I remember speaking to somebody from the Russian Security Council who was saying that the way he put it is not that they were opposed. They don't want the Baltic states joining NATO. They don't want to see NATO enlarged. And I wonder, why is it being enlarged if we're, you know, it's not being enlarged against us? But he was saying that really they would have to consider what enlargement meant. If it meant military infrastructure, if it meant positioning of forces, then that would be unacceptable. So that seemed to me that they were opening up some space for saying, well, membership of NATO, you know, maybe we could accept that, as long as it didn't mean building up of kind of military forces or military capability against us. And here, I think, is even more an area where they will expect some quid pro quo for their support of the U.S. In the war against terrorism. And I think something we tend to overlook here is just how important Europe is for Russia. I think Putin has been looking especially to Germany and to Britain as allies, and I think hoping in that way to forestall or get around whatever crisis might happen with NATO enlargement.
Mm-hmm. That just to make sure that people understand what it is we're talking about here, certainly the Russians were not all that happy about the idea of admitting former satellite countries.
Right.
The Hungarians, the Czech Republic, and Poland, they were not all that happy about that, but they were even less happy because it's closer to home when we start talking about the Baltic countries. And here, just so people don't get confused with the Balkans, here we're talking about Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. That's much closer than Poland, and the Russians were even less happy about that than they were about the other countries becoming involved.
Right, right. And I think, you know, one of the things that, to my mind, the Putin represents is, I think for the Russians, the 1990s were a period of loss of illusions. Loss of illusions about how easy it would be to make an economic and political transition to the market and democracy. Loss of illusions about the West, and including the United States, and the feeling that really in the end the early hopes for partnership and for very high levels of aid were not realized, and indeed that the U.S. was pursuing interests opposed to those of Russia, and also a loss of illusion about the power and status of Russia and its place in the international system. And I think the Putin's policy is one of a kind of pragmatism and realism. The Russians know they have a very weak hand, and they're trying to play it as best they can. And I think myself that they were committed. Putin in particular looks to Europe as a way to help Russia and to integrate Russia into the international system. And I think then the attacks on September the 11th provided a kind of opening for him to make clear where he stood. So I think the very quick and decisive Russian position, it wasn't totally out of the blue. It was a reflection of attitudes and trends in Russia itself. And I think the problem, the danger is that, again, there may be illusions or certainly hopes that as a result of this support, Russia will, the U.S. And Western Europe, or the EU, European Union, will pay much more attention to Russia's interests and take account of its needs. And I think at some level it is a political gamble for Putin. It's a gamble in a way I like to see him make, because I think it's the best thing for Russia to be aligned in that way. But I think it is a bit of a gamble.
Just a few moments ago, we were talking about missile defense. And your point, I think, was, and I guess nobody really knows what the Bush administration does now. On the one hand, one would argue that the kind of defensive, as people have, the kind of defensive system that we were talking about would not have done anything to prevent the attacks in September. On the other hand, we are talking about homeland defense. We're undoubtedly going to be talking about putting greater resources into the military, and one could make the same argument that in the interest of protecting the United States, we need a system like this. So one could imagine going either way with it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The arguments work can be used on either side. My guess is that the focus on homeland defense embraces so many things other than missile defense, that those will receive, in the first instance, more priority. I mean, you know, building up stocks of antibiotics or vaccines for dealing with a possible, you know, bioterrorist attack. Money spent on kind of protective measures and so on, that may put the missile defense, may affect the timetable on that somewhat. But I'm not sure about that. So I don't know quite how it will play out. But it may well be that there will be more willingness listen to Russian concerns and to tailor whatever systems are deployed to, you know, reassure the Russians that these are not directed against them. Mm.
I don't know whether you would consider yourself to be an expert on the ABM treaty or not, but I guess I find myself, because I've talked with people who oppose the idea of the missile defense system and those who support it. And it seems that both of them are essentially saying, they're arguing both ways. People who are against it say there's no way to implement this without violating the ABM treaty, and that there are some people who seem to try to make the argument that we can finesse our way around it, and that it was possible to, you know, have the proverbial cake and eat it both, and that we could keep the ABM treaty and do what it is that we want. Is actually that possible?
Well, I mean, the other signatory is Russia. So if Russia agrees to a modification of the treaty to allow certain things to happen, then that's fine. Mm-hmm. Then, and, you know, that was the kind of Clinton administration's approach, was to try to induce Russia to agree to certain modifications of the treaty. Now, some people, advocates of missile defense, would say, well, that's hopeless. You know, let's get rid of the whole thing, because otherwise we're just going to be constantly, you know, trying to negotiate changes in the treaty to allow us to do certain things, and that'll make us do things that are technically not the best things and so on. So I think it is possible to get a Russian agreement, I mean, where Russia says... the whole, which is what the Bush administration says, yes, we're not in the Cold War anymore. The threats have changed. It makes sense to deploy some missile defense. Let's scrap the treaty, but we need something to replace it. We can't just be told, well, you know, the Americans are well-intentioned, and either we scrap the treaty or scrap bits of it, or but we want some kind of framework. We want to know where our strategic relationship stands. I mean, the Russian line is that they, you know, their retaliatory capability is certainly not under any threat in the next, say, 15 to 20 years. But they need to, I think they don't want to put money into building up their own strategic forces. And they don't want to get involved in any kind of arms race with the United States. So is it possible to for the U.S. to go ahead with a missile defense system of a kind that very clearly doesn't threaten Russia and doesn't, and here's the key thing, I think, doesn't threaten to create an infrastructure which would allow, you know, another American administration to say, oh, well, we've changed our mind, now we want to go ahead quickly and build a bigger system. And that's actually the big military worry, I think, is that even if you start small, you create the infrastructure for something bigger.
We have about 6 or 7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, David Holloway from Stanford University. We're talking about the relationship between Russia and the United States in the light of the terrorist attacks in September. Questions are welcome. We do have someone here who would like to join the conversation. Others are welcome if you call up quickly. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in southeastern Illinois on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, you've really been touching on this at various points in the discussion, but strictly in psychological terms, I mean, psychologically, an enemy remains an enemy, even in psychologically, even if, when it no longer is in reality, until that old enemy can become a friend by aligning itself against a new enemy in the way that, for example, Germany became the friend when it aligned itself against the Russian threat after the Second World War. And what we seems to me that we have here is a new psychological enemy that is going to replace Russia as the psychological enemy. I mean, it's a new alignment against another foe that so long as Russia wasn't replaced by anybody, the shadow of the image of them as an enemy remained, but with a new enemy, that we can align ourselves with Russia against, that the psychological picture changes entirely.
Right, that's an interesting point. I mean, in some ways, a sad point if you know, people can former enemies can become friends only if we find new enemies. But it's certainly true that the whole way in which we look at Russia is very much shaped by the way we look at the world overall. And I've been very struck at the warmth of President Bush's comments about President Putin and the Russian position. He certainly seemed to appreciate the speediness of the Russian response, and the fact that, as he mentioned, when he put the U.S. forces on a higher state of alert on September the 11th, the Russians actually reduced the status, alert status of their own forces, just to show that they understood that this was not directed against them. I hope it's not true that we need an enemy, although I suppose it is true that if we have an enemy that can be described in one word, even if we don't know exactly where he is or who he is.
Well, isn't it in some way an advantage? I mean, suddenly we have an enemy that is no nation. I mean, no nation really is described as the enemy except as it... that nation protects this vague enemy, which tends to threaten everybody.
Well, it's true that, I mean, there are a great number of people who are aligned. I mean, states basically are fearful of terrorism, especially if it's going to be directed at themselves. And it is also true that, as you say, that this is not against another state, but against a particular kind of movement. And that does have certain advantages. It carries a risk too, I think, which I suppose is one that an apprehension that people have, that it's very important then always to make sure that you separate the enemy from the other states or from broader communities, so that you don't end up having a broader or bigger enemy than you started out with.
Yes, thank you.
Very good, thank you. Just to finish up here, we have a couple of minutes. We talked about the Russian war in Chechnya, and that is, from the Russian perspective, that's about keeping Russia together, because the Chechens were interested in declaring their independence. There might be other people within Russia who would try to do that, and the Russians wanted to be very clear that they weren't going to let that happen. And one of Russia's neighbors, Georgia, there are two areas where they have been fighting the same kind of battle, Ossetia and Abkhazia. And that's gotten some news coverage. I wonder, though, either around Russia or perhaps some of the other republics that those that were former Soviet republics, where there is more of this going on that maybe in the Western media we're really not hearing very much about.
Well, when the Soviet Union broke up, I mean, a number of wars started on the former territory of the Soviet Union. You've mentioned, well, Chechnya was one. You've mentioned two in Georgia, Abkhazia, around Abkhazia and South Ossetia. There was also the war between Armenia and Azerbaijan over the territory of Nagorno-Karabakh. Mm-hmm. Which was populated by Armenians, but was part of the Republic of Azerbaijan. And that's a war which is in a stalemate at the moment, with terrible effects on both Armenia and Azerbaijan and their economic development. Another war was the small war, relatively, in Moldova with kind of breakaway province there, but it looks as though, you know, that also, there's a ceasefire there. There have been a number of wars which have followed the breakup of the Soviet Union, most of them to do with the issue of secession and desire to change territorial boundaries and jurisdictions. But the war in Chechnya is the one that continues, and the others are not. There's not heavy fighting going on, even though the political issues themselves are not resolved.
Well, there we will have to stop. I want to say, Professor Holloway, thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our guest, David Holloway from Stanford University.